after I finished, I'm from Los. My name is Frank Catalano, and I'm from Los Angeles. And this is the first 10 pages. Am I in the right spot? All right. And with me, you never know. But you know what? Even if I was in a different one, I'd do it anyway. So it's okay. I have an improvisational workshop that I'm doing for writers today. And then I'm going to, hopefully, if this is nice, head back home before it gets too crazy with the rain. Because my daughters are watching my house and they say, ooh, it was raining really hard last night. Anyway, I hope everybody's safe. Are you guys okay? Is it a little warm for you in here? You all right? Okay. What I'm going to do is I'm going to tell you a little bit about myself. Yes? Oh, you're just... And this is purely optional. I have an email list, but you guys can give me your email, and I will literally send you in writing what I'm going to go over today. And if you'd like that, you're welcome to it. And any other questions you may think of on the way home or whatever. And this way we can communicate. And I'd be more than happy to do that. So I'm going to start that, and we'll start it here and end it down there. And how many of you, this screenwriting workshop, how many of you are active screenwriters? You know, you have screenwriters you're trying to get out and develop. Okay. And how about novelists? Oh, okay. So we have a primary. Okay, and you're thinking about developing your screenplay towards a novel kind of a deal? Oh, just want to just kind of see what it is. Okay. My background, in case you haven't read the bio, I've spent some time at various motion picture studios in various capacities, both in production and distribution. I was at a company over 10 years ago, called Lorimar, which was a television production company. They did do movies, but really not significantly. And then from there, we were bought by Warner Brothers, and I spent many years at Warner Brothers in various aspects as a consultant. I had a producing deal there, which they call a first look producing deal for motion pictures and television. And I also did some consultation and packaging and like that. Now, we're not going to cover a lot of that today. Some of that would be in what I'm about to talk to you tonight, but we're not really going to cover that end of it. What we're focusing on today is this idea of this screenplay, right? We all have, and I think I mentioned it in the workshop yesterday. You could go anywhere, and I don't know where you guys are all from. Is anybody here from L.A.? How many from L.A.? No one. Most of you from San Diego? A few? And where else? Where are you from? Utah? Okay. Any place else farther? Arizona?
North Carolina.
All the action's going on back there right now. You're from New York? Oh, great. What part?
2 hours up the Hudson.
Oh, Long Island. Can you detect that little accent there? Long Island. But I've been out of New York a long time. Anyway, you could go into Los Angeles at any place, and I did this actually one time. I was at a Wells Fargo, and I was talking to somebody that I knew online. I said, how many people on this line wrote a screenplay or have a screenplay? All of the tellers raised their hand, and pretty much everybody online. And so a lot of people, I guess the reason why I'm telling you that, in Los Angeles, in your particular communities, it's probably not as intense. But Los Angeles, and specifically Studio City, where I live, which is near all the movie studios, you're going to get more people doing that. So bottom line is, there's a lot of product floating around. And everybody's either, if people are fortunate enough to have representation, they're trying to get their product in front of somebody to look at. Or sometimes you get in. Did they have a pitch workshop here? I thought I saw something. Yeah, sometimes you don't even get to give them your screenplay. You know, it's a pitch kind of a thing. So I thought an interesting workshop would be, and I know some readers and people that are involved in the business, they go, I got this script. And somehow some very good ideas in a pitch. Somebody says, I got this great idea, and they go, oh, let's take a look at it. Then the screenplay follows that pitch, and somehow it gets lost in the process. And what we want to look at today is how do you, if I can share with you my experience, when you do submit your script, how can you hook them in those first 10 pages? And, first 10 pages, that's a catchy title. It could be 12 pages. It could be 3 pages. I pick 10. And the reason why I pick 10, and I'll go over some specific stuff, is that a lot of times if you're trying to get an agent or any of you playwrights? No, okay, you're a playwright. That's right. They'll say to you, oh, send 10 pages over and a little bio. So you got 10 pages to try and sell some ideas. So you're giving them a little log line of some sort. And then you give them your 10 pages, and most people, pick 10 pages, out of the middle of the script, their best 10 pages. And my thing is, you really want to give them a kind of an idea of where your screenplay is and where you're going, and you don't really have a lot of time to do it in. And here's the other thing. From the big picture, one thing that we all can share in common is that we are all audience members. We all go to the movies. I don't go as much as I used to. But, I mean, we all watch television. We go to the movies and we see that. And my question to you is this. Let's think of it in the larger frame. What about the first 10 minutes of a motion picture or a television production? Now, we just had, this is January, but this fall we had the pilot season. Did any of you guys see any of the new shows that came out? And you want to ask yourself, out of those new shows, what makes you watch out of that onslaught of shows, two or three maybe will make it. And this season's a little weird because of the strike. And so we don't know how that's all going to shake out. But usually, out of that onslaught, two or three kind of are what they call the breakout hit. And so what elements do they have that makes us keep coming back? What are they doing that makes us keep coming back? And when you go to the movies, have any of you seen There Will Be Blood? What did you think about the first 15 minutes of that movie?
Kind of slow.
Yes. And there's no dialogue even.
Yeah.
What, did you see it?
No, I was going to say I saw Cloverfield, and it was the first 20 minutes.
Oh, I was going to go see that. Should I not go? I was going to go tonight. Oh, well. The trailer is great.
They
should have.
You see that? How many of you have seen the Cloverfield trailer? That's got to be your first 10 pages. And I dare you, none of us have seen it. Try and tell me what Cloverfield. Don't tell us. All right. What's Cloverfield about? I don't know. It's some scary thing, right? That's shutting the lights off and, probably a dinosaur it looks. I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. So what does that say about us that you could watch a trailer and say, well, who is this guy? He's telling me to do this screenplay and he wants it to be like the Cloverfield trailer, which doesn't say anything. Well, what's that? You got to do certain things to hook people in. Yes, you do. But we want to create a beginning that somehow pulls the reader in to what we're trying to achieve. And that's the challenge. People want to, the writing workshops, and I walked around, I saw all the books and everything, and they all look really good and everything. But the reality of the situation is, and I kind of talked about this yesterday, and it's not in a book, it's just my personal opinion. You could agree with me or disagree. Television has forever changed us, the way we look at the world. And we are all kind of trained for this immediate gratification thing, all right? And, William Shakespeare, when they start the prologue of Romeo and Juliet, they kind of set you up for the story. It's this tale of star-crossed lovers and two households. If somebody had that, you're watching the pilot season and you give them this screenplay and it's two households, both alike in dignity, they go, okay, yeah, great. All right? And you say, well, what am I supposed to do? Am I supposed to say, welcome to this, and they die at the end? No, you can't do that either. You have to find a way to pull people in. So part of what I want to explore with you this morning is to teach you or to share with you about developing a character and a story and an audience hook within the first 10 pages of your screenplay so that if it gets coverage, or you may not even get 10 pages. Some people go to the pitches. I was at a meeting, and I think I said this yesterday, so people who've been here, I'm sorry, I'm repeating myself. This guy goes, what do you got? And so the writer says, the Russians, yeah, landed on the moon. It's the 1960s, they landed on the moon first, and nobody knows. And the producer goes, who gives a shit? What else you got? And that was it. That was over. And the guy went, sound a little like Jimmy Stewart. Well, it was over. So you got to pull them in, you know, and really kind of set it up, and maybe it'll work. Maybe a Cold War story will sell now. But I think we were talking about Cold War yesterday. A lot of people don't even know what the Cold War was. I mean, I teach college. Did I tell you to teach at USC? I should have said that. I've been at USC a long time, and a lot of young people really are missing the most, you know, they'll tell you about the Civil War or something like that, but if you mention the Cold War, they really don't have a hook to that. So maybe a Cold War picture will work, but you got to set it up so people will know, you know, Cold War was a time, you know, when blah, 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 and you set it up that way. So we're going to look at that. What key elements of character and story must you have so they won't put your screenplay down before they started reading it? So you got to give them a little character. I think There Will Be Blood doesn't give you very much. Let me ask you a question. How many of you have gone to a film, and I said we're all audiences, and in the first 10 minutes of the movie, and essentially, you know, that's kind of the first 10 pages of the screenplay, you were kind of going, what the heck's going on in this movie? Anybody could think of any of the... What?
The Deer Hunter was like 45 minutes.
Before you get it.
Yeah.
How, any others that you can think of? Don't let me die up here. What? Yeah, that was the next question. How about a movie like Hunt for Red October? The one that I love, and it's old by now, but I love because I've read the book many, many times, Jurassic Park. It pulls you in the first 30 seconds. All he does, and he doesn't even go to the book. I mean, the beginning of Jurassic Park is in Jurassic Park 2. You know, the beach thing. He just goes with the camera and it's... And he's getting closer and closer to the Velociraptor. And so you're sitting there and say, well, you know, it's Jurassic Park. I know it's a dinosaur, but it sounds really mean. I'm going to hang and see what this is. And they get you really close in. Any others that you really liked that you could think of? Any, you know what? It's really funny. How about the movies that are out now? Has anyone seen 310 to Yuma or... You know, the ones that are out, they're almost forgetful, a lot of them. That's why I can't remember that. Yes, sir?
Indiana Jones series right away.
Right away.
Yeah.
Right away. Yes?
Cloverfield is kind of an example of you don't know what's going on in the first 10 minutes. It's a party. That's it.
Yeah, it's a party. I'm going to go see that. Is it really that bad? I'm going to go check. I'm very interested in that. You saw
it.
Okay. But when I saw that trailer, I said, you know, like when you're sitting in the movie theater and you go, loser, wait till that comes out for DVD. And even worse than DVD is, wait for HBO. That means I won't even spend $3.99 on that sucker. You know, any others that you liked? Yes. Okay, so tell me about that. I've seen it, but I mean...
The movie opens up with a man kind of stumbling on all these dead people out in the middle of nowhere. And he has to figures out right away, I think, just through action, there is no dialogue, what happened, and follows a trail of blood up to a tree, and there's a man sitting there with a briefcase full of money.
Right, and off you go.
Yes.
From there. And it's not, I've seen that film, it's not a real roller coaster beginning. It's not a Jurassic Park, you know, get on the thing and never get off. It's a slow roll, but it gives you as you go, so you stay for the ride. Any others that just jump out? And
The Illusionist.
I forgot. I've seen it, but he does a trick, doesn't he, in the beginning?
He does tricks, but it starts off as a kid, and as a poor guy, and friends with the rich girl, little girl.
Yes.
And then he runs into this magician who disappears a tree, and then he goes.
You know what? I remember that. Yeah. So now you're saying I'm interested. So that's what we want to go for. And you may be thinking, and you might be right, you say, you know, I wrote this screenplay. That was the director that did that, maybe, or whatever. You know, it happened at a production. And that may all well be true. But we as writers need to think that way. Because television has changed the way we look at the world. And if people don't get immediate gratification in some way, shape, or form, and I'm not saying we're a bunch of mindless newts or anything like that, but I'm saying if we're trained with multiplexes, think about where we are. Multiplexes, television with cable and satellite and TV remotes and all of that stuff, DVDs and internet, we go, we're watching this, you know what, I'm not going to do this. And how many of you, I know you won't admit it, have walked out of the movie in a multiplex and gone to another one? You just go, oh man, I'm out of here. Right? And so we as writers have to provide that, if not for the audience, for our own benefit, because it's so hard. Everybody, it's not like that. We're not doing a conference here on dentists, you know, where you have to get a degree and you can't work on anybody's teeth until you get a degree. Anybody can be a writer. You know, I'm not saying a good writer. Anybody can say, I'm a writer, get a business card done. And so Hollywood or the film business is filled with those people. So in all fairness to the people on the receiving side, they're getting so much stuff, you got to make your stuff kind of break through. How many of you are represented by an agent for screenplays? Okay. So, and there was a lady here yesterday, there was actually one writer had an agent, and she said she had an agent. And she liked the agent. And I will tell you that anybody who's had a relationship for a long time with anybody, whether you're married, boyfriend, girlfriend, whatever, sometimes you love them and sometimes you hate them, right? And it's like a stock market. And so that's why I say you like your agent. Because a lot of times an agent can work with you. You have a project. Let's say you do this book. And they love your book and they send it out and, you know, it gets published or maybe it doesn't, and they start trying to pitch it around and nothing happens. Before you know it, you're on the back burner because somebody else is coming, and they're going to say, oh, well, you have this project, or you have a book, or three books, or five books, or seven films, or whatever it is, and you go, I'm trying to get something else going on. They go, oh, well, here's so-and-so. So you've got to constantly reinvent yourself. So it's not just up to the agent. You can't say to me, well, I'm going to write any screenplay I want to write, any way I want to write it. You've got to help them out. You know, it's a participatory thing. Okay. Characters and things like that we'll talk about today. And this is the other thing that I love, and I've always thought about that. We are all marketed to. Probably since you got up out of bed this morning, you've been pitched somehow, either on television, you know, exercise. I watched, they had some girl doing abs this morning. I mean, somebody's always trying to sell us something. And we need to think in terms that when we have a screenplay, or a novel, or a nonfiction book. I mean, it really applies to everything. We have to create a promise so that if you do this and you take this journey with me, this is the promise. You open this page or you go to this movie, you go to the Cloverfield, I promise you, you don't know what it's about, but this is what I will promise you. You're going to be scared out of your pants or whatever. And then we pay our $12 or we buy the book, we pay our $29, and we go and we read it. And either we are fulfilled or we're ripped. And so I bought a book one time. It was on a rainy day like this, too. And it was called The Next 10,000 Years. And I didn't have a lot to pick from. I don't know where I was. I said, all right, what the heck? The Next 10,000 Years. I'll do it. You know, so I'm reading the book. And about halfway through the book, and it was a rainy, I was in a hotel, I realized that the writer was crazy. And you know what I realized? When he started saying, we're going to dismantle Jupiter and do all this stuff. And I remember getting the book and flinging it across the room against the wall because I said, I can't believe I did that. But I looked at the cover again, and there it was. There was the promise. I'm going to promise you a vision of the next 10,000 years. And who doesn't want to see what somebody thinks about that? And it turned out to be some ranting, crazy guy about dismantling Jupiter and doing these crazy things. And so we have to somehow come up with our idea that when we write our screenplay, when we write our novel, that there's a promise that we can make somebody. You know, I'd rather think in terms of it as a promise than saying, oh, you know, what's your log line? I hate that when somebody says, give me your log line. I know all the writing teachers do it, but I hate that because can you imagine if I asked you, hi, Bill, how do you do? What's your log line? How are you going to describe yourself to me in a log line? You can't. We're all very intricate people, and we are always being forced to label ourselves and corner ourselves in a certain way. And I want to think that we're better than that. Why do we have to describe everything we do in a log line? I want you to think in terms of read my screenplay or invest in me. Forget my screenplay. I've got 10 screenplays. If you don't like this idea, I've got 9 more. And we all did, right? We all have ideas. Some of them are on the back burner. Some of them are like cars jacked up in a garage, right? They're almost done. They have a couple of wheels missing. And then we have the ones that are finished. And so invest in me. I will make you a promise. And I'll deliver. I'm the kind of writer that blah, blah, blah. I write wonderful characters. I write interesting stories. I write adventures, whatever it is. And become that person as opposed to being reduced to some formulaic log line. You know, man meets beast in hotel. You know, people having party meet beast at Las Vegas hotel or whatever. What does that say? So, you know what? You may do it and you say, he'll call you. He'll email and say, you know what? I did what you told me to do and it didn't work. I want my money back. But it's just for me, I think we gotta change the way people do things. You know, when I went to Warner Brothers and I was younger then than I am now. Oh, yeah, that's not saying much. But one of the companies I'd worked to before, and even, you know, the film studios are old. Believe it or not, if anybody knows anything about cinema history, they were formulated on the model of Ford Motor Company. They didn't get together when the Warner Brothers got together and Zanuck got together and all Louis B. Mayer, a part of for MGM, and the guy that I was thinking Bob Balaban, it's not Bob Balaban, it's the other guy, Zukor. There was a guy named Adolf Zukor who founded Paramount. They came out to L.A. looking at all the land, and they said, let's see if we can create a creative process where we create a product every week. And it's not a mystery that if we go back to the 1930s, you could say, I know exactly how many movies Paramount released in the Golden Age, 52. One a week. That was it. Like a factory. Get a team together. You guys are the mystery people. You do two mysteries a year. You're the Western folks. And, you know, whatever your studio, you know, if it's Warner Brothers, it's Westerns. If it's Paramount, it's mysteries and romantic comedies and so on and so forth. And your job is to crank out, you know, these things. And you're the writer. And here's novels and convert them and I'll pay you a salary. Nobody owned anything. The studio, they were all employees. And the studio cranked out the work. That's the mentality that they were creating something for that. And that mentality still exists in many ways today, even though that system doesn't exist. It's even though it's a freelance thing today, everybody's always asking you to boil everything down into a minute or so. And I don't know if any of you, has any of you ever gone to one of those pitchy kind of meetings or anything like that for your books? No. You have. In L.A. kind of a thing or where you live?
North Carolina.
North Carolina. How about where you? Yeah, so you get that like 30 second. And how did that make you feel?
Pressured.
Yeah, pressured.
Frustrated.
And so my thing is, and we should start a revolution. No. We need to change that and be self-empowered. And my, you know, I'm not saying, you know, you go and you flip the desk over and you say, read my book. No, you're not going to do that. But I'm saying is we, just because it's set up that way doesn't mean we have to play that way. And I will tell you, when I went to Warner Bros., I was about to tell you, it's a very vertical company. Lorimar, the company I was at before, was young, and anybody, the receptionist could be the VP. You know, in 6 months. It was that, there was no rules. And I love that idea. Warner Brothers was you only talk to your supervisor, and that super, you know, was a very paramilitary, old style studio. And I remember trying to pitch projects over there. It was like you had to go across a certain kind of a thing, and you had to do this, and very male dominated for the most part, which was okay for me. Not good for you, not good for you. But it mostly male dominated, and it was a very traditional kind of a way, and they had a certain idea about movies. And I did a deal with them, what they call a development deal, for what they call a boutique studio, which was low budget, not low like a million, like actually $20 million to do. That's low budget for Warner Brothers. And we would get name actors to direct, like Mel Gibson and people like that. But the ultimate analysis is, although they agreed to it, they had no intention of ever making a $20 million movie. You know, when they want to spend $100 million on a movie, it makes them feel comfortable that that's going through the pipeline and that's what they wanted to do. So there's a mentality that we need to change in the way things are doing. And you say, well, come on, 10 pages here, give me a break. But it's part of the mindset. Let's get back to your script. What do you have to work with in 10 pages? You have description, action, and dialogue, and I'm going to add to that your title. And a lot of times I have seen ideas sold on a title. They don't even look beyond the title. You know, There was a movie. You remember Disney did Rocketeer? And there was a project floating around at Warner Brothers called Rocket Man. And it went very far. It didn't get made because of Rocketeer, because it was a similar story. But, oh, Rocket Man. Let's take a look. Rocket and Man. It's intriguing. And that title was getting through to a lot of places. And that's interesting. It's just the title, and then it made its way, you know, kind of like the salmon upstream. And then it didn't go any, because then Disney came out with Rocketeer, which really wasn't like Rocket Man. You know, it wasn't a guy with a pack on his back. But once you said Rocket Man, that's what they thought it was. And it was dead on arrival. But anyway, so you need to have a good title and something that works and in your first 10 pages. And what that title can be, you know, we could do a whole discussion on creating ideas for titles and working them out. And some of you, sometimes as writers, I don't know if you do this or not, I do, I'll, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning, I'll wake up in a cold sweat and I'll have a title and I just write it down. I just write the title in, and I have a file in Microsoft Word with just titles. And I use them from time to time. I just did a project last year, and I needed titles, and I was pulling little titles for, you know, it had placards. It was a play. So keep a list of titles, not to say that it's going to change your subject matter, but perhaps when you're developing a title, developing a story, excuse me, that sometimes the title you may pick may not be so literal. So if you are doing covering a story, which is the one that the National Treasure, the one about the Lincoln assassination, it's called National Treasure, Book of Secrets, The Truth Behind the Assassination of Lincoln. That's an awful title. But I'd say, let's say that's your project. You say, I was researching, especially, you know, there's all sorts of historical things where you are, and you come up with this letter, you know, like this was the John Wilkes Booth thing, and you say, wow, you know, this conspiracy, that's your pitch. I got a conspiracy thing, just like the Russians landed on the moon, and you got to come up with some kind of interesting title to fulfill that. And National Treasures doesn't, I mean, if they made it, but they were stuck with National Treasures from the other movie, I guess. But you want to think about titles. Write as many titles down as you can. And I always love, and I'm going to tell you a little thing I do. I cheat like hell. When I read the newspaper, sometimes I'll combine words. I get access to information on the pilot season. And when we see the television shows, those 5 or 10 that make it to the season and the 3 that make it to series, there's at least 150 pilots behind those that never come. And some of them have the greatest titles. And I write those titles down. And sometimes I'll take a word from one title and a word from another, so I'm not plagiarizing. But sometimes they're meant to be pilots especially. And you may not be a pilot writer. You're a novelist. You're a screenwriter. Bless you. You're a novelist, you're a screenwriter, but you take a provocative title, and then at some point in your life, there'll be it's like a locomotive. You'll attach some cars to it, and it'll be a train. You know? And so a title's very important. Then you have description, action, and dialogue. Let's talk about description. First, the thing is this. None of you said you wrote plays. But you know, have you ever read a play script? Or you said you write plays. When you open up those Samuel French things and it'll say, at curtain, the Muldoon Manor on a Christmas night, stage left. And they go through this laborious description of the setting of the stage and where the furniture is. You know, on downstage right is a grand piano. A bay window overlooks the scene as snow gently falls out, blah, blah, blah. It's beautifully written. You can't do that in a screenplay because they won't read it. So you have to literally go, fade in, interior night, Muldoon Manor, an 18th century restored manor in Long Island. The bay window overlooks Long Island Sound as the snow falls gently. As the snow falls gently, Lawrence Muldoon, I'm making this up, so if it sounds retarded, that's probably why. Lawrence Muldoon, a crusty but benign college professor, makes his way down the stairs and moans, ugh, and you're in. That's it.
professor living in a manor?
Well, yeah, it's true. I told you, I just made it up.
His wife
is rich. Should I write that down? Or maybe, well, maybe that's why we want to know. Why is he rich? He was a U-boat captain. He scuttled his ship with Nazi gold. Bill, we should write this down. I don't know. I'm making this up. That actually sounds pretty good. Has anybody got a pen? Anyway, what I'm saying is you're not going to be able to luxuriate in that kind of description of setting. You've got to get to it pretty quick. And I've seen, have any of you heard of the writer, and I don't necessarily recommend this person as a writer, but he is the most economical writer that I've seen scripts coming across my desk, named Shane Black. He did the Lethal Weapons, you know, those kind of movies, you know. And, you know, I was at Warner Brothers, so that's why I would be there. And he would be cut to, you know, fade in, cut to day, police squad, you know, whatever. And it's like, and blah, blah, blah. And it's just boom, boom. And when you read it, it's like, my God, 10 seconds has gone by. I'm already on page 3. And you're almost out of breath. It's just, if everything he, it's not brevity. It's everything he does propels you to the next thing. Nothing is wasted. So when he talks about something, it's pushing you to the next thing. And you read that, and that's pushing you to the next thing and the next thing. And you're like, trying to keep up with this guy. There was a period at Warner Brothers where every screenplay I had in front of me had the obligatory on page 15, 35, sex scene. And then they would go, you know, he nibbles on her earlobe and blah, 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 you know, does this whole page and a half of this, you know, stooping scene, you know, like that. Shane Black goes, he hugs her, they fall on the couch, you know the rest. Turn the page. That's it. He goes, I don't want to describe whatever. And that's it. And you go, in my mind, which is the point I'm about to get to, is he says, you know the rest. He's saying, you're reading this, participate, get off your butt, and use your imagination. I'm giving you this, this, and this, figure it out.
Clint Eastwood.
Yeah, exactly. And he's at Warner Brothers, too. So you have to let the reader, and remember, we're not writing, I'll get you, we're not writing for the director most of the time, we're writing for some reader. And there's actually a couple of readers here this week, and I heard them talking. And so they do coverage. If you give your script to Mal Paso, to Clint Eastwood, and he likes the idea, he's going to give it to a reader, and the reader's going to do all this stuff. So you got to let them feel like, hey, I'm playing too, as opposed to I'm so ridiculously stupid that you're going to do everything for me. And they go, oh, man, I know. So let them imagine the sex scene. Let them imagine the action scene. Yes, I'm sorry.
When you write screenplays, don't you write brevity like that? Because the director's in it.
And that's we're not even talking. What your point was, doesn't the director also get involved? Absolutely. And we were talking about that yesterday. But I'm just trying to get you sold. Then they're going to change it again. And, you know, that's, what are you going to do? And the same thing, I don't know if any of you have written any action scripts, that people have a tendency, I have not read Hunt for Red October, and you just made me think about reading that. But these action-packed scripts where they describe, he raised with his left hand and he was hanging over the dirigible. I don't think it's that at all. I think it's real quick. They give you enough to picture it, and then we create it in our minds, and it goes very quick on the page. So description, let the reader participate. And no stage directions. Unless it's integral to the plot. You know, I'm carrying the briefcase, you know, with the Nazi gold, and I put it down with my left hand and simultaneously, something. Yeah, of course you can do that. But I'm saying, don't say it was a swank briefcase made of 1920s leather. You know, we don't need it. And maybe a line or two which describes it, I think, would be better. And so that's important. Action, the same thing. When you get to those action sequences, like the sex scenes, things, don't put a lot of description in there. Really keep it brief. Tell them what's going on. I mean, if this is an action sequence which is different in some aspect, you know, if it's, I wouldn't put in, although I've seen it, you know, he chases him down the steps, down through the subway, and they hop in their cars and go. We've all seen it before. I wouldn't put that.
You know, this is a different kind of chase. And I would love to see the, and I haven't read that screenplay, the Italian Job with the Mini Coopers.
Yeah.
That probably isn't, I think the director did most of that. I think the writer just put in, you know, they chase each other all over Italy and wherever. So economy, that's important in the first 10 pages. And dialogue. Now, here's the thing about dialogue. And it really kind of, I'm not doing an advertising for my improv workshop. But every character has their own slang. And I don't necessarily mean they go, they don't talk like this, you know. It's not about that. Every character has their own kind of inflection and economy. So you want to capture that very early on in perhaps their first bits of dialogue when you start introducing these characters. How they respond. Do they only ask questions? You know, any little nuance you can find with a character. Do they hesitate before they speak? Do they have a dialect? Or do they have a hint of a dialect? Like in the little example we were doing, if he were the U-boat captain, I would give him a little twinge of a German dialect. I wouldn't make him sound like, you know, the fair, this is what we do. No, not that. Like Muldoon Manning comes up, fair, this is an interesting morning. You wouldn't want that. But perhaps one or two words, you know, and you go, God, that's odd. That's a hook. That's a hook. And they go, why did he do it that way? Why did he say Wiener Schnitzel? Or whatever. That's a hook. Yes?
I've heard mixed reviews about starting a scene with like a telephone conversation.
Oh, yeah.
And even if it's quick and snappy and doesn't pour information down the reader's throat, is it still cliche and trite?
Here's the deal, and I mentioned this yesterday. A lot of the meetings I went to, and I went to some meetings with some, you know, fairly big directors, and I was kind of like a little fly on the wall. And you know what they talk about? How am I going to show this story? They don't use the word tell. I always thought they were storytellers, but they're not. They're story showers. How am I going to visually show this story? And the problem with the phone conversation is it's not the best choice. You know, let's say they say, tomorrow at 10 o'clock you will die. You know? Maybe that's okay, but say, tomorrow when you're wearing the red suit after you get up and stop at Starbucks, you will die. You know, it's too much. It could, you know, you're not for counting. That's true. You know the one that uses the phone call really well is the one with the ring, right? I mean, yeah. Every time that thing rings, it propels the plot. Every word is used. But some writers, like to use the phone conversation as a method or a tool for exposition. Where they go, hello, yes, I haven't seen you for 3 weeks. Where have you been? You know, well, I was out playing polo. You know, no, you show all of that. Or not. You know, maybe he drags himself in, he lights up a cigarette, and he throws his polo bag on the floor. I don't know. But it's a visual way of doing it as opposed to using the phone call. Yes?
Well, I'm struggling with the fact that my character is trapped in a kitchen, but there's an inciting moment that propels her out of her old life and into her new life.
And it's the phone. Oh, but that seems okay.
As long as it's not.
That fills my definition of propelling her to the next, or him to the next thing. Okay. I think that's okay. I just wouldn't make it too chatty.
Right.
You know? Unless it's one of those things, ring, what are you wearing? I don't know. So dialogue is important. Give your character a slang. And maybe a slang is a bad word. But you know what I'm trying to say is give your character some specific hook that says something about them. Not only are they conveying information about the plot, right, which you want them to do, it's starting to bring the reader in to say, who is this person? As opposed to, oh man, I've heard this a million times before. So we want to bring them in, and that's a little way you could do it. You could do it with economy of description, and you're taking them along the way. And I love this. Did I tell you I teach acting, too? I haven't told you guys anything. But I teach acting. And one of the things about acting is you've got to let the audience participate. And the same thing is in writing. People want to play, too. So you've got to give them a few clues and let them participate and pull them in. If they're sitting there passively, and you may write beautifully, All right? I'm not even criticizing that. You run the risk of them going, yeah, this is really nice and it's beautiful, but click.
Are you talking about vernacular and idioms?
Yeah, perhaps. It depends on what you're writing. Let's forget about that, vernacular and idioms, at this point. Let's just say we're doing a contemporary piece on a real estate agent or something. What about this real estate? When you see, I saw a hand up there. Was there a hand? No. When you see a contemporary piece and it's a real estate agent, what do we think about real estate agents? I'm married to one, so go easy on me. But no, we think, oh God, they're salesy people. So what if this real estate agent comes into the scene and they have something just a little different about them? By the way they speak, it could be through dialogue, it could be through the way they act, the way they dress, some little thing. That's a hook. So that's what I'm talking about. Creating something interesting early on that makes the reader say, what the heck was that? I think I'm going to stay another page and see what that was. Or, wow, they screwed up there. No, and then they go, wait a minute, they did it again. And so you're writing on a level which is a little bit different. Television has a tendency to want you to go point to point. Now, I told you I did NYPD Blue. What I mean? It's in my bio. And NYPD Blue, one of the things I hated about NYPD Blue, and you're from New York, they have Italian American or the New York thing, everybody sounds like a Goomba. So, hey, what's going on? Hey, you know, I'm doing my PhD thesis here. You're got a PhD thesis. Why would you talk like that? And everybody they did in NYPD Blue always had that kind of, you know, hey, I'm talking. And they always did an accent. You know, you're talking about dialect. It wasn't a real New York. And I say, you know, I'm from New York. We don't talk like that. You know? And it would always be that kind of thing. And you know that's what they were going for because they've said, oh, well, a television audience, it's NYPD Blue. So we got to give them the NY. You know? Yes, sir. Yeah.
Only because he's a product of his age.
Yes.
He comes from the 30s.
So you've got a vernacular of the period.
Right. And he's living in the 1977 now.
Mm-hmm.
But he still has these idioms.
There was an actor, this guy wrote a play, it was a movie. I don't remember, it was a play or a movie. It was the 1920s or 1930s, and he had the line. He was playing a Southern or New York. It was New York, and he had the line "Jigaboo," about a black person. And the actor said, "I will never say that." And it was appropriate vernacular for whatever the period was, 30s, 40s, whatever.
But he had to be saying it to a certain.
He said, "I won't say that word." He said, "That's politically, you know." I said, "No, you don't understand." I said, "In the period that this takes place, people did say that." Well, I can't do it. I have an audience. They won't do that. But you come into problems with that. And you know that HBO series they were doing about the West? What was it called?
Deadwood.
Otherwise, I was going to have to call you all at 2 in the morning. Deadwood! No, I'll do it better. I'll go like this. Deadwood. Writers' conference.
Yeah, what
yes, sir.
Did you see the assassination of Jesse James with Brad Pitt?
No, I did not.
Because they used
very contemporary.
There,
yeah.
But they got that the person who's communicating to cannot hear, and so he asked, "What did you say?" And then they switch it off, so they only hear it one time, but they don't repeat it.
Okay.
This is in the 1800s.
But in Deadwood, I felt that the vernacular was modern almost. And I guess that's what they were going for. They were saying, you know, suspend your disbelief. These are cowboys, but we're going to talk modern. And everybody went, okay. It was a little jarring for me. But anyway, so it could be vernacular. It could be a unique quality of your character. But in the dialogue, you want to find something. So you create compelling description. You create compelling dialogue, compelling action. That's always a mystery. And you're pulling them along. You don't have to explain why they take the revolver and put it in the drawer or wipe it off and hide it. Let them figure it out as you go along. Yes, sir? Yeah, there's a danger of that. Well, you know, in the theater, this is such a cop-out answer, but I'm going to give you the good answer. In the theater, you have readings. We were talking about that. You have stage readings. And they go, you know what, this does not ring true. It's a little bit too much. In screenplay format, you don't have the benefit of that. But if you get feedback on the screenplay, if they do coverage on it and they say, you know, on these particular pages, I'm having a little trouble, I'm losing the story. And that's when you'll know you're in trouble. When they're going, huh, what is that? You want them to be in pace with you. This is what we all strive for. And as an audience, as a reader, in any way, shape, or form, when you go to a movie or you watch a television show, excuse me, I'm so sorry about that. That's my daughter. It's not my ring. It's her ring. Let me shut that off. I have a teenage daughter.
Nice way of diving out.
Yeah, I know. I'm in trouble now. You think I like Gwen Stefani on my phone? I'm dead. But anyway, we hope as an audience or as a reader that we're in pace. Don't you hate when you go, oh, God, I know exactly. This is so cliche. We change the channel. Or when you're so far behind, you go, what the hell's going on here? And in Where There Will Be Blood, who saw, one person saw, I felt, and there would be blood. It was going so slow. I said, I got to be missing something. This is, you know, is this right? And it was too slow. So somewhere along the line, that's what we strive for. So the tools that you may use to pull the reader along, if you're starting to feel that you're getting feedback in the report, or you read it out loud, you have your friends read it, and they're saying, you know what happens here? You know, you say, well, this is the part where he gets called by the FBI. And everybody goes, I didn't get that. That was the FBI? Well, didn't you see that little badge? No, we didn't see it. Then you say, you know what? I got too much going on, and you pull back a little bit. Did I see a hand there? Sorry about the Gwen Stefani. Anyway, so we want to add those things, and then... No, I don't. Well, whatever. I'm making it up as I go along. Don't forget the promise. And I like that better than a pitch. And look, here it is. And we're running slow on time, or low on time, but this is what they do. And you tell me if you've had this experience, but I know they go, oh, hi. And I'm not, even if an agent goes, hi, I'm Frank Catalano's agent. I'm, how you doing, Fred? Here's that script I tell you about. So they take the script. I've now got the script, right? And I got it in my hand. And as he's going, yeah, it's a really good story. You know, it's about this guy. He's a Nazi U-boat captain. I'm feeling the weight. Feels a little heavy. Then he turns his back. How many pages? All right? And they all do it. No one will tell you this, but they all do it. They're looking for that thing to come in at 120 or under. And if you hand out a script 140, and I've seen writers, you know, don't do it. Because is it impossible for it to get read? No, of course. Someone might read it. It's just you're adding more obstacles. So you've got to get your story down to a minimum of 120 pages or less. And if you could tell it in a little less and they still get it, great. Because they just won't do it. Yes, sir.
Braveheart, how many pages do you think?
Braveheart was probably long, but it's Mel Gibson. So, you know, it's an 800-pound gorilla. Mel Gibson walks in the room, you know, he hands you 200 pages, you know.
When Wallace wrote it, how many pages did he
present? I think it ran long. Yeah. And you're leading me to my next thing. They're going to look at, they look at the last page, and then they're going to, you know, of course they're going to look at the title, then the setting. And this is interesting, and it's a little off topic, but it's important. How many of you have stories with flashbacks? Yeah. It's you got to handle them clearly and importantly, because you got two strikes against you with a flashback. And here it is. When they do coverage on it, anything that's period costs more money. So I've had writers come in with these great stories. That one that took place during the Kennedy assassination was really interesting. And the feedback I got is, can't you just make it now? But the writer said, that's the whole idea. It's the Kennedy assassination. Oh, we can cut that. And it's like everything else would stay the same, actually. No, really. And it was like, then we don't have to get the old cars, we don't have to do all this other stuff, and we can knock off 25% out of that budget. And so you say, here it is, and let me get my devil's horns. Would you do it if I take the Kennedy out and we'll make your movie? And so the writer's going, do I do this or not? You know, and it's an interesting thing. Can you tell the story? And the flashback thing is, I see it used a lot in cinema. You know, you've got to be very clear on how you set it up. So there was a movie, and I helped the writer do it. Here, they read it, and they go, well, how are you going to do this? You know, you've got her playing this now, in 1963, and now it's 1990. How do you do that? And I said, I have a great idea. Do it like Peggy Sue Got Married. And we learned from other people. I said, it's the same actor. Because they're saying, we've got to get a kid actor, and then we have to get another actor. No, it's going to be the same actor. All they're going to do is, when they go back the 10 years, and I think we cheated it a little bit, maybe not 20 years. I said, they're the other actor. They put a sweater on, you know, like Peggy Sue did. She played it the same way. So they go, oh, that's great. We don't have to hire two people. And then you get into it. So the flashbacks are very important because the reader will say, wait a minute, what's this? Is this now or is it then? And then you've got to also, in your description, and again, you do this in brevity, you have what I call the macro and the micro. So you're doing a story, let's say it takes place, it's a horror movie, and it takes place in a castle. All right? And you go, okay, that's easy. That's the micro. The macro is, it's during World War II. And you got to make sure how you do that. So that when they do the reading, when you get, you know, the idea of coverage, they will do a budget on that. They'll say, wait a minute now, we got to get, you know, 4 U-boats and a couple of Messerschmitts and all that other stuff. So you say, well, here's my castle story. And then it just talks about this town during World War II and this tank crew. Now you got one tank. Like that. And you shouldn't have to worry about that. But I've seen a lot of screenplays not get, they pass on them for the stupidest things. So things don't get passed on. In fact, I was talking to someone last night at dinner. We were talking about, you know that workshop somebody did here called Why Good Screenplays or What Good Novels Get Passed On? And that's the reason. It's the dumb stuff. It's like, it's a good story, but we can't afford to do 2 U-boats. And stuff. So when I mean, you say, well, I don't want to change my story, you just do this to it. You just go, shh. And you still tell your story, and everything goes a lot easier. I'm going to finish here because we're almost done. Economy of detail is important. I'm still telling you about this script. They're going to feel it. They're going to look at the pages. They're going to look at the action, the situation, the dialogue. And what you want to do is develop a promise, whatever that promise is, and try, if you can, by the end of those 10 pages, deliver it in some minor form. You know, like a cliffhanger. Think of your... This is terrible. I know I will be struck by lightning when I leave this building. Make your first 10 pages like a trailer. So you're intriguing them, and you leave them hanging. So the FBI or the U-boat guy, let's stay with the U-boat guy, he looks out on the beach, and he looks out in the sunset, and in the distance you see a little piece of a old rusty periscope, a low tide, or I don't know, I'm making this up, cut. And so you want to do the rest, buy the screenplay, and I'll take you there. You know, whatever it may be. As opposed to, we all want to show all this stuff, and sometimes the arc is so long, we don't give them enough. And so, leave them with that promise, give them an inkling of the promise that it's going to be that journey, and then just kind of leave them hanging at the end. And hopefully they'll go beyond your 10 pages. Yes, sir?
Uncle Richard's niece is dying, and it's 1900, July 4th, and she says to her secretary and her grandson, write in my diary, it was the end of an era.
Mm.
You're saying, leave them with that.
And yeah. Just leave them. Yeah, you say, I'm taking you this far. I'm taking you to the corner. And I'm holding your hand. Look at what's down that street. And they see an ominous or a happy. But I'm not taking you down there. I'm just going to leave you here right now. Have a good time. And just back away. As opposed to saying, well, and then this happens, and then this happens. And we're always overselling. We have to break the mold. We got to change the way we do things. And of course, you'll all email me saying, thanks a lot, pal. My agent fired me. But anyway, I want to thank you all. If I have an email list going around, I'll email you guys. And if you need any of this stuff, I'll be happy to share it with you. Thank you very much. Drive safely if I don't see you. Thank you. Pleasure.